From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty. It's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us.
We've got some fresh new young talent doing some things that I know you haven't heard before.
One, two, three, listen.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, from who knows where, is Roger Mitchell. Roger, there?
Yeah, I'm in who knows where.
Where is
sitting at my desk
this week?
I'm in Lugano today. In Switzerland,
okay.
On the lake,
a different lake.
Yeah.
Well, good to talk to you as always. Now, we've got a fantastic guest coming up who I'm going to let you introduce shortly. But before we get to him, anything caught your eye this week?
Yeah, a few things. You know, isn't it funny how Man United's panned out? You know,
no one could say they didn't see it coming in if they listened to us.
Yeah, well, we've had doubts about this from the start. I think in episode one, we talked about a lack of balance at the club. And then when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer started and, you know, it seemed good, we ourselves were calling it a dead cat bounce. And now we are back where we were. These players are not playing for the team. You know, my view is very simply, you know, if you set a club out to be a money-making exercise, you will be treated the same way by the talent.
That's a great point.
It's just, you know, that's what Sanchez is doing. He's saying, well, you guys just bought this club to pay down the LBO, to pay down the debt. Why should I bother? You know, like, I've got my contract. We're a legalistic company, nothing to do with sport. So get off my back. And that's where Man United is now. I think they're in a dreadful, dreadful position because people have clocked on that they don't know what they're doing in terms of football. And it's all about whether the cash flow can pay down the debt.
Yeah. Well, how do you think a team like Barcelona have managed to avoid that?
Well, one reason is that every so often they get to re-elect a president. And, you know, okay, then you could say, well, it's populism and you play to the crowd.
But that president always brings in the marquee signing. So yeah, to me, that would potentially make the problem worse, that they decide, oh, this is the guy who I need to make my election go through, so get me him at all costs.
Well, you know, I think it's more than that. I don't think it's just people saying, well, you know, you've promised me this, I'm going to go for that, like the bulk of politics is these days. I think it's what I would call connection to the fan base. You know, they feel that every so often they've got a say in the club, and hence whoever's running the club tries to remember that. And, you know, their motto is more than a club. I think, you know, and there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast that are like this. I think they believe that the worm is turning a little bit and, you know, the fans are going to become a key factor in making sure a sporting organisation keeps its balance. They've been kind of like kept on the fringes forever and in many ways, say, you know, taken for granted. I think smart sport organisations now will engage them and will use them as a counterbalance to, like, what's the phrase, keep me honest. I think that's what United's missing just now. You know, they just don't have anybody to keep them honest.
Well, look, you can't give me an opportunity like this and expect me to pass it up, Roger. You mentioned smart sport there, which is the perfect segue to actually introduce our guest. So why don't you let people know who we're going to talk to?
Well, today we've got Chris Cairns, who I've known for, let's say, 6 months. Chris is one of the top cricketers to ever to come out of New Zealand. His numbers back that up. He's probably one of the top cricketers globally. And in the grand tapestry of the life of these amazing people, the people that go onto the sport field, he's played snakes and ladders at a level most people haven't thought about. Top achievements. And then he hit one hell of a snake when he was accused of match fixing, something he was exonerated of twice. So Chris has, in the greatest tradition of storytelling, had those six or seven ups and downs. And he's, you know, coming up again with new ideas about where sport's going to go. And he talks about that from the point of view of an athlete and know what happens. So Chris, I think it's going to be a great interview. It's a smashing bloke, great conversationalist, great company, and I think a top bloke. Good morning, Chris. How are you doing? Or good evening to you.
I'm very well, Roger. How are you?
I'm good. More importantly, how's my friend Grant, who's at the middle of the night?
Chris, welcome. How are you? Good to have you with us. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you. I'm honoured. It's very nice to be on the show. I've listened to a few podcasts and looking forward to it.
Fantastic.
Good. As we heard in the intro, this is quite an amazing and intense story, which we're going to take our time with, if you agree, Chris. And the place I think we all want to start is talking a little bit about you being the son of a very famous sports athlete in his own right, very famous, and you're his boy, and how the hell does that work? What's the dynamic? Just,
Chris, you can skip the conception part. I'll tell Roger about how that works off mic, okay?
Very funny, Grant.
Well, shall I start? He was 20 years old when he had me, Roger. So that was sort of, you know, whether I was a mistake or planned, I mean, that's another conversation. But no, Dad and I, we actually have the record for the shortest space of time between, the father ending his career and the son starting. I think previously it was something around 14 or 15 years. And I think it may have been a Pakistan, I think, father and son. I can't remember who it was. But so Dad and I, we only had about 4.5 or 5 years between us. So I started my career at 19 and Dad sort of finished his around 35. So a lot of the blokes that Dad played with, I actually started my career with them. So I went from calling them Mr. Smith and Mr. Crow in the dressing room to sort of calling them Hogan and Smithy, which was a bit odd. But it was an honor. I mean, my dad is a legend in New Zealand, and you know, he's sort of the folk hero of New Zealand cricket. Richard Hadlee was the superstar. But Dad was very much the people's favourite, yeah.
But tell me, you know, he comes across very much from the old footage as a pretty severe guy, no nonsense, no messing around. I mean, I can imagine that you being his boy, it can't have been a bundle of laughs, Chris.
It's funny, mate, because I think, you know, you see some offspring perhaps, you know, have difficulty with it, which can mean that it can turn them off the sport. They don't really want to follow down that path, and some get pushed away from it because of that, I suppose, expectation that can be placed upon, the offspring of highly successful men and women athletes. But, you know, I never really viewed it in that capacity. It was sort of, my heroes were Viv Richards and Ian Botham and that sort of type of player. Dad was a, you know, very unorthodox bowler, and you know, and look, I mean, he won't mind me a minute. He was a slogger, so he was like he had no technique at all.
That's not fair.
But he just, you know, but I loved watching him play, and you know, that six sixes at Melbourne in 1981 lives in the memory with every New Zealander, and so, you know, I was as proud of him as a fan of New Zealand cricket as I was of him being my old man. And so, again, you know, it was never really a burden. It was odd. I mean, because like I say, some people sort of determine it that way. But for me, mate, it was I never saw it as detrimental.
So tell me, Chris, when you were a kid, was he getting you into the nets really early, or did he care, or did he want you to do something else?
No, he was away a lot. You know, back then, tours were long. You know, they'd be in England for, gosh, 3-4 months, or touring away, and the game was sort of almost, it was still amateur. And so he was working and putting food on the table for his family, and then trying to make a career as a New Zealand cricketer and getting paid $50 a game or whatever it was back in those days. And so, you know, and he was a young man with a young family, and so I never really saw a whole lot of him. And then my folks split when I was around about 10, and Dad sort of moved up north. He didn't come to my first game of cricket. I remember I was about 11 years old, I think, that he came to. And, you know, again, it was great to have him around, but I think it wasn't until I got to about 14 or 15 that he sort of saw that was the path I was on. And, you know, and he gave me, if not thousands, hundreds of thousands of throws in the nets, and spent a heck of a lot of time on technique and bowling understanding. And so, yeah, it wasn't until it was a bit later that he, you know, he started to spin his sort of web around my development. And you know, and he was, you know, arguably the most influential character on my career, absolutely.
Chris, was there ever a point where you kind of didn't want to get into cricket, or were you ever a rugby player? Obviously, New Zealand, that's the other big draw down there. Was it always cricket?
Yeah, it was always cricket. I mean, I played rugby. I went to the right school, so I played at Christchurch Boys High School. So I played South Island Schoolboys and played made the New Zealand under 17 rugby on the bench, and I played against Tim Horan, actually. He was a freak schoolboy and in that era he scored about 3 tries against us at the old if you remember Athletic Park in Wellington, that was the old rugby ground there, and and so you know, I went to the right school and got on the right teams from a rugby perspective, but no, it was always cricket was just the thing which, you know, made me want to get up in the mornings and play, and conversely be disappointed if it was raining. And so that's, you know, I think the hallmark of really where your passion lies.
Can you just talk about, because there'll be people out there that perhaps don't understand the place that sport has in New Zealand. I mean, it's a different world down there. Just talk a little bit about what sport means to New Zealanders growing up, and kind of the pressure that comes with being, because it's different down there. It just simply is.
Yeah, it is, and I think also because because of the population size or lack of size, then there's only one degree of separation. So you know everybody really. So nobody gets above their station. And it's a case of, you know, the fans tend to keep it real. The All Blacks, for me, I mean, that's a whole different kettle of fish. You know, the All Blacks to me are a remarkable sporting brand, and their win ratio is remarkable. And considering the size of the nation and what it is and the pressure that gets put on, I've heard, you know, numerous All Blacks say that, you know, winning is a relief. It's almost not, it's the enjoyment's there for sure, but it's a relief to win because of that expectation. And but that drives players, and, you know, different players have different motivation. But on the cricketing side, we sort of played a second fiddle to rugby, and we would pop our heads up intermittently with success. You know, for a period of 6 months, we would have a good group of players come through, and they might go for a year or a couple of years through late 90s and 2000s. And then, you know, we, because of the the natural fall away, we would sort of drift back again, and then you get another group come through. But, you know, for rugby to maintain its level is quite amazing.
Roger and I've talked about this at length on the podcast. We spoke about the All Blacks, and to your point, you know, they're just an unbelievable organization. But there's a feeling that this commercialization of the All Blacks has changed a lot about them. You know, the last few years they've got serious about the brand and everything else, and it now seems that, you know, that the haka, which to everybody was just this mythical, magical moment in sport, is now, you know, for 6 months a year you see it every other week. Is there a feeling in New Zealand that, you know, you talked about the fans always keep it real, is there a feeling that the All Blacks are turning into everybody's team instead of New Zealand's, or is the love for them undiminished?
Good question. I think, and look, I live in Australia, so I tend to look back in to New Zealand these days rather than sort of being, you know, here at the focal point. But, you know, I think with the amount of rugby that's played globally, the push for the commercial dollar to stay alive, to stay competitive, you know, it means that the All Black brand is going to be pushed. And you're right. I mean, it's like sort of playing the Lord's Test five times a year, you know, or having Wimbledon four times a year. It's not going to happen. And if it did, it would dilute what goes on. So I think it's a reality of the world we live in, and, you know, the commercial drivers that go with that. But I still think that, you know, that haka is something, you know, something else. And, you know, when you see it performed and you see, you know, the fervor and the passion that goes with that, you know, that's a great thing. But it's something which I think the New Zealand fans still gravitate towards that All Black environment, and, you know, because it is such a big part of the culture. And but look, don't get me wrong, I mean, as the world becomes more global, New Zealanders, there are more cultures here now. There are more sports being viewed. There are more people with different outlooks on life. It used to be back in the 80s that it was rugby and cricket, like that was it. But now there is a more global outlook. And so how that changes New Zealand, I mean, that'll be really interesting to see how that occurs over the next 20 years.
Staying on rugby a little bit, we've spoken a lot about rugby the last few weeks and months because of everything that's happening with CVC. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think if you scratch a little bit below the surface that you'll know more about than anybody else is the threats that are going to be around New Zealand rugby, New Zealand club rugby, as that sucking sound from the Northern Hemisphere comes. Because, you know, today, correct me if I'm wrong, people can't play for the All Blacks unless they're playing their club rugby in New Zealand. Where do you see all that ending up?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I think that runs parallel, Roger, with the IPL, where, you know, as that's grown from a cricketing perspective, and you know, it's cut down the international calendar with regards to taking the players over to perform in that league. You know, you're getting the situation as you've alluded to with rugby, which is the money trail would it'll dictate where players go. I mean, you know, ultimately players have a finite period, far less than most people do in their own professional lives, for a window to maximize their talent that will leave them in their 30s. And so if that means at the moment New Zealand has been, I don't know whether it's extremely lucky, but the value that the players place on the black jersey is amazing. It really is. You know, you've got guys turning down hundreds of thousands of dollars to sort of go north with a view that they want the black jersey. But at what stage is there a tipping point? And as you said before, CVC, who were a big player in Formula One, you know, they commercialized that sport no end. They've obviously seen an opportunity in rugby, and they're making a really big play, as they've done with the two rugby union leagues in the UK, and they've got a deal on the table for the Six Nations. And you know, it's it's a tough one for the Southern Hemisphere, because how can you deny a young player heading north if he's if there's double the amount of money on the table? I mean, do we admonish him for leaving and some would say turning his back on the black jersey? But if he's going to double his income over his career and look after his family and extended family, is what's wrong? You know, and this is the dilemma that I think New Zealand potentially may face in the coming years, because there's going to be more pressure placed on those players with regards to what's going to come in the door. And, you know, that's a really tough call for them, really tough call.
I think it is a dilemma, but it's interesting, because I think that dilemma would have been faced much longer ago for anyone else than New Zealand and any yes. other sport than rugby. You know, it's one of those things that, to your point, people just don't understand how these what it means. Yeah. I mean, they had that fantastic Amazon documentary, All or Nothing, about the All Blacks, and you really got a sense from watching that of just how central to everything this is, but also, you know, this fantastic no dickhead policy that the All Blacks have. I mean, it's Roger and I have kind of remarked upon what an incredible organization it is, and it kind of has become an organization which is perhaps the thin end of the wedge, but it is truly amazing that these guys do just, well, they don't think twice about turning down hundreds of thousands of dollars because they want that black jersey.
It exactly, and it would come from family as well and friends, but at some stage, what's enough? And I think there would still be a little bit, like I read an article with Kieran Reid, who's obviously one of the top players in the world at the moment. You know, he's leaving New Zealand rugby at the end of this World Cup. And, you know, I read the article where he sort of said that, you know, at the end of the World Cup, it's time for him to take his young family overseas to experience, life overseas. Well, yeah, but there's also a better deal on the table. So there's still a reluctance in some respects to acknowledge the fact that you're going for money. Yeah, New Zealand still doesn't quite, you know, grasp it, or maybe the players feel that the public don't grasp it, but I think the public do grasp it. And I think the players should be honest, and they should say, look, what would you do? You know, like, what am I supposed to do here? There's a wonderful deal for the next 3 years I've got playing for Bath or Gloucester. And I'm taking it because, you know, I've played my bollocks off for New Zealand for this amount of time, and I'd like to capitalise in the last few years of my contract my career to make a wonderful contract. And I think if that was what was said, the public would be fine with that because they get it. But there's still this sort of mystique around the fact that, you know, it's, oh, I'm not going for the money. It's because, you know, it's a chance for my family to explore the, you know, a foreign land. It's like, I'm not entirely sold on that.
Yeah, you don't fool anybody, pal.
No. So just be honest, because I think that's the stage that it's at. And I think if someone lays the ground with it, the public will be okay, because they'll say, well, of course you have to go. Like, that's what we would do. Yeah. So that's what's on the table, and it's the right thing to do. You deserve it. So yeah,
I'm loving the fact that Roger and I have one of the greatest cricketers New Zealand's ever produced, and we're spending all this time talking about rugby. let's get back
that's the podcast
let's
for
get,
you.
Let's get back to cricket, because you alluded to the fact earlier on that the game has changed significantly. You were talking about your dad, and they were basically amateurs, and you've basically, your career has spanned the change from cricket being essentially an amateur sport into being a professional sport. You know, so you've actually gone through that. What was that like? Because, I mean, it must have been one of those changes that you could actually see happening, isn't it? It's a big change, but you can actually see it happening up close in real time.
Oh, mate, I remember in my first tour in 1989, during the lead-up games to the first, there was a test match, it was a one-off test in Perth. It's actually where Mark Greatbatch batted for about 17 days, and we saved a game. But I remember in the lead up to that, we would come back from the practice game at the Adelaide Oval, and we would go down into the house bar, and we would hand out drink tokens from our sponsor. So we would go and have beers with, you know, the punters who were around, because that was one of the sponsor activities that we did, and that sort of whole evolution, and, you know, we went from sort of having a beer afterwards. It was radical, like this introduction of having ice in a bath and sitting in it. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, recovery wasn't half a bottle of JD. It was actually stretching and running and recovery. And so it was my old man. He's somebody actually, and look, because his dad is highly inappropriate. I would never let him loose on a show like this. But he's someone who he sort of said that, you know, a good night out for him back in his playing days would be front page of the newspaper today. Yeah. And it's because I think of the like, he never wore a brand on his shirt. There were never this sort of sponsor relationship. So really it was just a case of they used to, you know, mingle with public and get out there. And the journalists who were on tour never blew their cover, because then they'd never get on another tour and they'd never talk to the players. And so it was a different time. And once the sponsorship and the brands and the money comes with that, of which the players benefit, but there's a payback, and that means that there's accountability, and that means that there is you know, awareness of who you're representing. So it's a different time, and you know, you just adapt. And so I, as you say, I saw sort of that older era, and then came through into that professional one. And it was look, both of them have great aspects to it, but just different.
Chris, I want to come back to, you know, the IPL later and that whole commercialization. I want to stay a little bit because we're very lucky on this podcast sometimes to get proper sportsmen. We get business people, we get broadcasters. But, you know, when we've got the luck to have somebody like you, like we did have with Eddie last week, you know, we need to ask you, you know, what goes on in that damn head of yours? You know, like, when do you know you're good enough? You know, like, what makes you different from the other guy in your team that was good but just didn't have the head for it? You know, tell us a little bit what it takes to become a world-class athlete.
I think having spent so many times failing, because that's what you do in sport. It's you fail more than you succeed. And I, at the end of it, when I look back, retrospectively, I think if I had one piece of advice for any young athlete, male or female, it would be how you validate failure. Because we can all succeed, we can all have the good times, we can all have a great night, we can all have that ability to have that great performance. But because that's not the norm, the norm that we live in is within failure. So it's really about how you validate that concept and how you deal with that. And I think you'll find the best and the greatest are the ones that fluctuate the least. The ones who are brilliant to watch and volatile are up and down, but brilliant to watch. But those that are the greatest, I think, just have less volatility, and also they understand that failure is part of the gig. And if you're able to process that, I think you give yourself a better chance. So, and that's all I ever really tried to do, man. I mean, people used to sort of say you're only as good as your last performance, but for me, I'm only ever as good as my next performance. And so, whether I got 100 or 0, I tried to be as neutral as I could be. Or whether I got some wickets or not, it's a case of getting ready for the next one. And the key along with that validation of failure is preparation and making sure that, you know, you whether that means going to the nets and having 5 minutes because you know that that's what you need, or you go there and have 5 hours. There's no methodology around that other than the fact that you've signed off. So if you, I think, have those two elements of preparation and validation of failure, I think you can begin to sort of see a path and see some light. Because it was sometimes when you're younger, you tend to overwork or underwork. You don't quite get that balance right. And then you sort of live the highs and lows. And I think, you know, as you evolve, those tend to get softer on the highs and lows, and you understand what it is that you need to do pre-match to then give yourself the best chance. So it's really, mate, it's really those sorts of, those elements, I think, which are the most important.
Chris, how do you reconcile that? Because, you know, what's interesting, I remember seeing a fantastic ad campaign that Michael Jordan did at the height of his career, and it was all about failure. You know, it was, I've missed so many shots, I've lost so many games, you know, it's all this stuff. Yeah. And he says, I failed over and over and over again, and that's why I succeed. And that's always stuck with me. Mm. And hearing you say that just kind of brings that home to me with a sledgehammer, because to athletes, that's how you think. You know, it's all about, you know, the next game, it's all about how you prepare, it's all about this other stuff. And you understand that there are going to be days when you don't perform well. But the fans, it's completely the opposite mentality. You know, they couldn't give a shit about failure. They just want success. And there's no thought. How do you reconcile that? Because you're playing for people who fundamentally don't get anything about how you think.
Yeah, and that can be the beauty and the beast. And I think that's the wonder of the unscripted drama, which is why you turn up to the same size pitch every weekend to sort of see the same guys play, because you don't know what's going to happen. So then off the back of that, you know, you tend to, I think when you're younger, you can be a little more, should we say, less understanding of others' viewpoints, whether that be fans and whatnot. But I think as you get older, you know, you understand that it's a passion for those people, and so, you know, you tend to sort of view it in a different way. But for the first half of my career, I didn't really get it, and so I tended to sort of be a bit hit or miss. And then in the second half of my career, I sort of knuckled down a little bit and started to understand what it was about, and sort of got more traction in the second half of my career. But you know, it's tough. It really is, being in that environment and being in that spotlight. But then again, it's also so rewarding. It's funny because I never, you know, when you're out in the middle, I only see what I'm playing. Like, I don't, and it's funny because people sort of say, oh, you know, big crowds and whatnot, but you sort of don't see that. It's almost like you could put me, you know, against Shane Warne in a club game, and I'm as competitive with him in that environment as I would be at the MCG or the SCG. It's just a thing that you have. And so, you know, the fans that provide the color and the passion, mate, they're entitled to do that. And Australia definitely has the most colourful fans. They are crazy. Yep.
Chris, you talked there about being a younger player and then a more mature player. And I guess that takes you into the role of senior guys in the dressing room. And you also alluded to the fact that in the old days, let's say, things were a little bit more amateur. So you've told me in the past about some of the times that you've maybe, and I'm mentioning this because Eddie Pepperell mentioned it as well, famously, you know, playing the last round of the Open when he was hungover. Tell us a little bit about, you know, you've come in the morning, you know, got your whites on, you're hungover, and, you know, some of the older boys, what is it they say to you?
Well, I think, man, the one thing with cricket, like, it's 4 days. Or a 3 day or a 4 day. In an international game, you tended to sort of leave that side out. But the first class scene can often drag on and do those sorts of things. But I remember one of my first games, I think it was, in the first season, I managed to scrounge out 100 in about my fourth game or fifth game, and it wasn't pretty. And I went out and celebrated. And so the next morning I came back in worse for wear, and it was Chris Kugelein, who played a couple of games, famously caught Richard Hadley's, I think, world record wicket in India. Chris Kugelein at slip. And so he played, oh gosh, a handful of games for New Zealand, but he was a real character. And so I've come in very much worse for wear and lay down in the dressing room. And he just simply came up to me. He was with me that night as well, by the way. And he came up to me and he said, look, youngster, he said, man at night, man in the morning. That's all I'm going to say. And I sort of carried that. I carried that with me for the rest of my career. So if I did have a splurge, then you know you had to front up. That was it. So it was a good piece of advice.
So listen, let's move on a little bit. Talking about guys like that you looked up to. You mentioned Biffy. You mentioned a whole lot of others that, because you came at the end of a generation which one may say was a golden era for all rounders. You know, you would have Botham, you would have Imran, you would have your man Hadley, Kapil Dev, even Proctor down in South Africa. Tell us a little bit about those guys and what you saw in them. And, you know, I'm sure we'd love to hear some of the stories about, you know, what they were really like.
Well, they were all, I mean, to get that amount of quality in that era, I suppose in the era that I played, there was, you know, for a period of time, you had Klusner, Flintoff, you would put in there, Pollock, Sean Pollock, Jacques Callas, who arguably is the best of all of them.
Really?
And, well, Callas, I mean, his numbers are just off the chart. You know, when you look at what he did and batting three, you know, and the amount of wickets he took and the slip catches, you know, it's got him. And he was just, but he was sort of, you know, compared to Beefy, he was boring, you know, like, I mean, the way that he got his hundreds or double hundreds, or, you know, it was very methodical. And he's such a great technician, Callas, that it's almost like, oh God, okay. But when you look at a Klusner, or you looked at Kapil Dev or both of them, you know, it was just the flair. But with Callas, it was just a ruthless assassination of you and your team with his technique and his talent. And so it's hard to go past them. But, you know, coming back to those, I suppose that golden era, you know, with Kapil and Beefy and Imran and Hadley, they're all so different. I mean, you know, Sir Richard, very dry,
Sir Richard.
You know, very, very focused, unbelievably driven statistically. In New Zealand's first test win in 83 in Headingley, Sir Richard didn't get a wicket, which, you know, when you look
your dad got
back
him
on,
did he not?
Dad got 10. And so he got seven. He got seven first innings, three in the second. And this is, well, it was a bit of a comedy, a bit of a satire with regards to, you know, a drawing of the New Zealand team at the end of that test match, and everybody's up in arms and Richard's at the end in tears, you know, like that was, but that was how much, you know, he was driven and committed. And look, arguably, I think if Paddles was English or Australian, Paddles is Hadley. I reckon he would be considered the best in the world. But because he was a New Zealander, it sort of puts him, you know, just slightly down at the beginning. But you ask any of the players, I mean, he's a bit like Wasim Akram from my era. You ask anybody from my era, who's the player's player? Wasim Akram. And I think it would be the same for Hadley of that era. You know, who was arguably one of the best? Hadley. So it's very much like that. But look, all different personalities, big personalities, obviously Beefy. You know, Beefy's argument to finish anything really is, well, how many fucking test wickets do you get? So like that's not as many as you, Beef. Yeah. So that's his argument. And
I mean, he was just like so full of confidence. He was unshakable in his self-belief.
But that's why. But Roger, that's why he did so well in Australia. Like the Australians,
he
beat them back with their own brush. You know, like he was more Australian than the Australians, and so that was Beefy's mandate. You know, when he went down with that ridiculous, remember he had that those Rastafarian sweatbands, and he had that big mane of peroxided here. And he went out with no helmet and just battered them all over the park at the Gabba and got 100. You know, the guys, Murphy was bouncing the crap out of him. And, you know, that, he was larger than life. That's the way he played. But he, but what he did was that he drew the others forward. And so it wasn't just his performance. It's the confidence he gave Tim Robinson and Chris Broad and Eddie Hemmings and Neil Foster and Graham Dilley and all these other guys, because he lifted them. And, you know, that was, the, I think, the beauty of Beefy was not – oh, sure, it was what he did, but it's what he did around the team. I mean, that was remarkable.
Will Chris, will we ever see the likes of both of them again, or is the game going from a grassroots level to almost bleed that out of people?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's – cyclical. I think with the analysis, with the analysis that, you know, sport has today, you know, there's a way to do it. And I think sometimes it is cyclical, sometimes it does come back around to natural. But I think, you know, with biomechanics and understanding movement, there are ways to do things and there's ways not to do things. And to break that cycle, you have to be really unique, you know, so it's, and I don't think we'll get them as often. So like Malcolm Marshall, for example, you know, how would he go in the world of, as an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old in this coaching environment? And so, you don't know. And that's where I think, you know, you may not quite get the break. We'll still get them because people will find a way. There'll be a glitch or a kink in someone's technique that actually allows them to, you know, to do something different, which, you know, they can still do it with consistency. But I agree with you. It will be harder to get that original aspect, that flyer, out of the gates, because, you know, it's just not. It's not the way that's done, but it's just not, you know, a proven way. And I think, you know, at times you, with the amount of money in the games and with the way people are protective of careers and the way they do things, you know, you probably want to go down the more secure route. So yeah, it'll be tougher to get that flyer.
That, Chris, that's really interesting because, you know, one of the things I've always looked at about this kind of like more steady, reliable player and the more flamboyant, beefy type character. You know, you can go all the way back to Bradman in that dressing room, and, you know, Miller was significantly different. You know, what was the dynamic there?
Well, because Miller's one of my heroes. You know, he's someone who he played in the pre-war era, Second World War, and then post, and there was a group of players from Australia and England as well, like who were in the war and saw things, you know, that no human being would want to witness, and so they played their sport before the war, and then once the war was finished, I think it was either 48 or 49, you know, life was coming back, and that was the, I think, the first Ashes tour. That was the Invincible story, I think, for Australia. And so, you know, that was when things sort of kicked off again. And Miller, having been a fighter pilot in the war, you know, there was at least on, oh gosh, if it wasn't one occasion, it may have been two, where, you know, he was under the weather and, you know, from a big night out and missed that particular mission, which that plane went down. You know, and when you're dealing with that life or death scenario, I mean, in sport, we sometimes refer to sport as war, or you refer to sport as, you know, you've got to give it everything, it's life and death. Well, it's not, it's a game. So I think that changed a lot of perspective. And Bradman didn't go to the war. So he had a medical condition, which meant that he was unable to go. And so he stayed at home. A few of the Australian players went over into Europe. And then in 48, there was half the squad or in and around those sorts of numbers that were involved in the war, and some that weren't, either too young or were not able to go. And so there was a bit of a divide, I think, in that touring party. But everybody was pretty happy to be back into to normal life. And there was, you know, champagne was pretty free flowing. And look, they're there for 5 months. I mean, they travel for weeks or 5 weeks to get over there. And they're there for 5 months. They play all the counties and then the minor counties and whatnot. And then they've got 6 or 5 test matches. And so, you know, I think there was one situation with Miller and Bradman, I think, which sums it up the best. And there was a game, I think, at Somerset and at Taunton. And it was the lead up to the first test. And they'd been enjoying themselves, you know, out as they would, with everybody was excited that, you know, the Ashes was happening and it was all going. And but Bradman sort of put his foot down after the first day and sort of said, look, guys, I really want to focus in on the first test coming up, and it's hellishly important for us. So I'm going to put a curfew on. I want, you know, everybody in by 11. So it's like, you know, half the dressing room sort of thought, and the other half were like, oh, yeah, okay, fine. And so the ground the next day, all ready to go, full house at Taunton, and they're doing their warm-ups, which back then was a, you know, a cup of tea and a bit of stretch out in the field. So this is about, and at this stage, there's the team and there's no sign of Miller. So they're sort of just getting ready to go back up to the dressing room, and Miller sort of comes in through the gates, and, you know, he was James Bond. You know, he was the real cream boy. Swish back here, you know, great looking guy, batted 4, opened the bowling. So he's got the black tie jacket over one finger over the shoulder and sort of meanders sort of on through and then goes up to the dressing room where the guys are. Comes in through the door and there's just a stony silence, and Bradman's at the end sort of silently fuming, and Miller comes in and sort of reaches out his left hand and looks at the clock on his or the watch on his wrist and goes, 5 to 11, Don, just made it. And that sums up them. And you had half the dressing room going, oh yeah, you beauty, and then the other half sort of. But I think that was who he was. He, you know, he was and the players loved him. The players, you know, the players really did love him.
So Chris, what is it that makes a good dressing room? Because you've been in a lot, and some I'm sure are better than others. You know, as a fan, you kind of think it would be just pure harmony, but maybe it is a little bit of edge, a little bit of division. What makes a good dressing room?
Oh, bloody good question. And I think the one thing, mate, I think over all my time, it was that, you know, because I suppose the only way that I can give it back to people or fans of the game is to say, you know, you go to your workplace, you don't get on with everybody in your workplace. There might be a handful of people or even 2 or 3 people which you may socialize with. And a sports team is no different. It's a workplace environment. But for me, it was never about liking the people. It was about knowing that when I sat down in a dressing room and I looked across at Adam Perori, I know that he's going to be doing his job. And then when I saw Dion Nash or Nathan Astle or Stephen Fleming from my side, I knew 100% that I didn't have to, there was no edge for me worrying that they were not gonna go for it. And so it's very rare that you get in a dressing room where you look around and you've got that feeling with everybody, because some people, you know, there might be an injury, there might be an illness, there might be, you know, a technical problem that you know that they can see and they're not quite there, or the coach is not quite. So it's not a common thing that's there, but you know it when you get it, because you just look around and all you're doing is making sure that you're going to do your job. And I think once you are internalized and going, shit, I've got to make sure I do my thing here, then you know you've got something. Once you're externalizing and going, oh Jesus, I hope he's all right, God almighty, then that's for me the sign that something's not right. So when you're externalizing, but when you're internalizing and going, shit, I gotta make sure I go good here, then you know you got something. And that for me is the key, where you look around the room and you just go, yep, we're all good.
So how do you then, I'm going to flip that question on its head, and what do you do when you find yourself in a bad dressing room? How do you work your way out of that?
Yeah, it's tough. No, it's really tough, because, you know, if you're in a normal workplace, you might leave the workplace. You might go and find a new job. or someone there, or that's generally the mechanism. But in a sports team, you have to write it out. Or you might see in football, some guys might get a transfer, or there's things put in place to deal with that, or something gets cut, but then it might not be that person. So there's all, it, honestly, it's really hard to find, to get that thing, you know, where you're all in sync. Winning helps, for sure, winning helps, because, but it's chicken and egg, you know, do you get the winning because of the attitude, or does the attitude give the winning? And that's something that, you know, you have to find as a group. And but when you get it, it's really special, but it's hard to get.
Talking about dressing rooms and personalities, how do you deal with somebody who's got a very high opinion of themselves? I guess you could say somebody like Imran Khan, somebody that, you know, well, I loved Imran Khan, you know, like thundering in with those in-swingers, you know, the long hair. He always looked apart. He always looked like, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia type thing. It was great. But tell me a little bit about somebody like him in the dressing room.
Well, there was a guy, if you you may remember, Dermot Reeve. He was an all-rounder for England.
Very ungainly.
He was in that. But he was in that era with Warwickshire, you know, where they had was when Lara was there, and they had that one day where like Tim Munton and Roger Tews, and they had that Keith Piper was the keeper, Alan Donald was, but they had that great era, and Dermot Reeve was the captain there. He was, you know, he was a magnificent player. I think he tells some great stories. I mean, Imran, you know, was again a hero. I'd put him more in the callous sort of category. He's very correct with his batting, but he had that flair. With the bowling, but he did have an opinion of, you know, his worth. So he sort of like he was someone who was uber confident. And Dermot just tells his great, look, his accent is far better than mine. But he tells these wonderful stories where he was starting at Sussex. So you had Garth LaRue, like a tearaway South African quick.
Yeah, remember him.
Who was quick, he was rapid. And you had Imran as well. And so and Dermot was starting off, you know, out of school and you know, youngster and showing promise, and he would be put into the first team. But Imran thought that Dermot's name was Dermont. There was an N in Dermot's name. And so he would just call him, hey, Dermont. And so, like, and but Dermot didn't correct him because he thought, oh, I can't correct. I can't tell him that he's got my name.
It's Imran.
So he said, I can't tell him he's got my name. So he was Dermont for all the time. And so it went right through until, so the 92 World Cup final, you've got England playing Pakistan. And this was, you know, Pakistan had no right to win that game. You know, they only got like, I think, 190. They scraped to 190 or two early 200s or 190 or something ridiculous like that. And off the back of Javed and Imran having a partnership. And then they, you know, Mushi came in and Wasim just reversed the heck out of the ball. If you might remember, he got Alan Lamb with a hooping in-swinger. And then next ball, Chris Lewis with a reversing outswinger, so taking off. It was the other way around. Actually, it was Lamb with the hooping reverse swinger taking off stump, and then Chris Lewis with the wide angling inswinger just knocked his poles over as well. It was remarkable. So at the end of the game, the Pakistanis are like, they're cock-a-hoop. So they're in, and so they came into the English dressing room, and Dermot tells a great story. He said, you know, Imran comes in and his tiger t-shirt and comes and sits down and he's like Dermont, I just want to say that, look, you know, you've done so well for a player of your ability. and this is at the World Cup final, and it was like, but it was actually a compliment, but it was an Imran Khan compliment.
Not sure.
it was an Imran Khan compliment, but it was a compliment. So I think Dermot, being very gracious, was even then he didn't correct him. Thank you. I mean, that's very kind of you. But you know, he's very very good. But great cricketer. Great. He bowled. Imran bowled a heavy ball, but like Steve Harmison.
Heavy ball.
Yeah. You're heavy. So some guys do and some guys don't. But yeah, Harmison was the same. Harmison, there was only two times I ever thought I might die if I get hit in the throat. And Harmison during the 2003 season, when he had that golden sort of period, 2002 sort of through 2005, man, he was scary, like legit scary. Yeah, he was fast.
So when you see someone like Imran, the prime minister of one of the four or five most populous countries in the world, I mean, it's a testament just to how important cricket is in a place like Pakistan. But does cricket give you what you need for that kind of leadership, or is this purely the result of a popularity contest, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think in politics, you know, you don't have to look too far than America to sort of see what the popularity aspect does for you in that environment. Who's underneath to help you govern? Well, that's another question. But I think with Imran, I think he's always had an aversion to that. I mean, he went to, you know, one of the top universities in the UK. And so I think he's not devoid of a brain cell. So he's somebody, I think, that engaged in that environment and was aware, and I think had a deep-rooted sense back to his country, which was a big part of the reason that, you know, he believed they won the 92 World Cup. He built that hospital for his mother. And so it was that fervor and passion that did that for him. And so did that carry him into, you know, game mode politics? Probably. Can he make a difference? You know, you probably in politics, you don't really know until sometime after, like how effective it's been. But, you know, for a country like that, where often we don't hear a lot about, where there's 250 million people, you know, it's remarkable. So I can only wish him well and hope that, you know, he does something great with his time in office. And, I really do. Pakistan, I've got some great friends over there. Pakistan's a great place, and it's sad. We had the World Cup there, and I've had tours over there. And then, you know, of course, there was, lots of things occurred in that part of the world, which has made it unsafe for, you know, the perception of it to be unsafe for our part of the world. And then you only have to look at what happened in this country in Christchurch only a few weeks ago, and no one's immune. And that's the sad part of the world we live in at the moment, is that, you know, is that random nature. And that's the saddest part of it.
You talk about the Christchurch thing. I mean, that's something, again, you know, here's a situation where, I mean, it's so much more important than sport, as you said. But in a country like New Zealand, surely there must be tremendous pressure on the sporting community to kind of rally around and provide that kind of beacon for the public to grasp onto in such terrible times. Did you find that during
the recent... I've heard that, man, as well. But that just transposes, I think, the biggest example of that is India, Pakistan. When you see the political angst between those two countries, and yet within sport and the common ground of cricket, the players have huge respect for each other. And, you know, a lot of them are great mates. And then, you know, you have, it's very rare that they play that series against each other because of the political withholding of that possibility. And that's a pity. But, you know, when I think, you know, we've seen in many tragedies in Europe in recent times where, you know, sport is the catalyst to sort of get people back into life, because, you know, it's something to celebrate and we get enjoyment from when we do that. So sport is a good healer.
But Chris, you know, I remember reading again, I'm going to bring Michael Jordan up here, but both he mm-hmm. and Tiger Woods, you know, two of the most transcendental athletes in any sport of the last sort of 50 odd years. And there was always a knock on them that they weren't more political. They didn't use their position as more of a pulpit. I mean, as a sportsman, obviously that's an option you have. You do have a platform. You do have an audience. Is there pressure to do that, or is it something you try to keep away from because, you know, realistically, you just want to play your game?
Yeah, great point. You know, again, we only have to look at the NFL kneeling scenario. You look at Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, perfect,
you know, you look at the, yeah, and you know, LeBron is quite, well, not that I know my first terms, first name terms, but LeBron James is someone who is quite vocal with regards to his opinions of the current American president, or, you know, what he believes. And you'll get quite a strong group of athletes in and around, you know, coming. And then you'll get Tom Brady, who's completely vanilla. I mean, I come from a stable, which is, man, if you want to say something, you say it. And if you don't, you don't. Like, you just don't judge. You don't need to judge. If somebody feels that it's that important to them to deliver that message, great. How that's met by the people you're delivering it to, well, that's up to the people to decide, and the fans. And, you know, in some ways, the American football fans, the American NFL fans, you know, they turned off because they didn't want politics mixed in with their Sunday afternoon NFL. And so you had this really weird scenario where you had guys delivering strong messages, but you had a reluctant fan base sort of going, don't know if I want to hear that, mate. And so this was the interesting dynamic that the NFL are dealing with. And, you know, what is the right platform? What is the right soapbox to get up and deliver your message? Well, you know, if you're the athlete and you want to do it, well, you have to work it out, and there will be ramifications either way or not. But, you know, the one thing about it is that we all live in a society, well, we're fortunate to live in a society where you do have the capability to do that. So how you exercise that, you know, that's up to you. But there will it's a tough one. I mean, there's no right or wrong. It's just what is. But ultimately, the fans, they'll tell you.
Yeah. Chris, listen, so you're a guy that's had a magnificent career, you know, with the ball and with the bat. You outdone your father, which was no mean feat. You're at the top of your game. And then, as I said in the introduction, you hit one of the longest snakes you possibly can get in this crazy world of snakes and ladders. And somebody accuses you of match fixing. You take this guy to court. You win the case. He comes back at you because he's an important and rich man and accuses you a second time. And again, you win that case. 12 good men and true in London courts have acquitted you twice. But some would say that the industry, the sport, have never seen beyond that. Tell us a little bit about that part of your life and how you find the strength to get through it and move on to what you're doing now.
Yeah, it's something where, you know, I think this is about the first interview I've given in years. I think I've been honest. I've just really took my time to get over that. That was nearly 4 years ago. During that time, went back to 2013, which is, I suppose, nearly 6 years ago. You know, I saw the best and the worst of human behavior. I was completely outcast from the thing that, you know, I enjoy doing and I love. But the flip side is that the path that I'm on now, there's no way I would be doing what I'm doing now if I hadn't have gone through that scenario. So, you know, in a really weird sort of way, I've not that I've blocked it out or don't want to acknowledge it, because it's not about that. It's just a time in my life that I went through, came through, and worked through. And look, there's people out there who are way worse off than me and been through way worse than me. You know, it was, To me and my family, it was tough and tiring and you know, hellishly important for us. But you know what I did realize is often sometimes we can sometimes think that our lives matter in other people's lives, and we tend to sort of overthink things. And you know, for me, it was just a case of getting through that period, rebuilding and coming out again and you know, paving a new career. But look, it's something which has, you know, made me who I am now, and that's very much about what the focus is. And but you know, I don't, there's no way you can not deny it or as I say, not acknowledge it, because it's not about that. But it's really is, you know, what I'm doing now would never have occurred without that. So, you know, that's pretty much where I am. And I mean, that's the space that I'm in.
Chris, you know, I've had some experience of a similar but much smaller situation myself in my life, and it when it was a problem about something you had to do in order to restore your reputation, you know, and that's something that you know, in my head when this happened to me, you don't have a choice but to do that. You know, you just don't have a choice.
No, it's actually.
Did that make it easier? Because you realize there's no other, you know, this is my only alternative. I have to fight this.
Correct. And mate, it's the same. I mean, you'll find that with, you know, we're talking about things in life, which, you know, could occur and could alter your life. But then you're looking at people who have a medical situation where life and death is at their doorstep. And that shapes where they are. Sean Udall, I read the other day, has been diagnosed with Parkinson's. And his life is going to be far different than what he ever imagined. And so, you know, there's a great saying that life is but the shipwreck of our best laid plans. So I think if you adopt those types of lines and you sort of see it for what it is, you know, you take the knocks, and it's how you respond to that, and it's what you do. And I think that's the key. And look, I'm not saying it's bloody tough. It's really tough. But, you know, it's maybe, you know, you kick yourself in the backside and get up and get into it. You know, that's the option, because what's the other option? So, yeah.
So when Mordi decides to accuse you of this, Chris, what is how do you deal with that? You know, like, you know, as Grant says, you obviously have to fight it. But, you know, do you go back and think, well, why is he saying that? What are the episodes? You know, there'll be some people that have actually got no idea what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know in your life it's been the most important thing of the last decade. But, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, why this came about and, you know, how you got through it. And you came through it twice. You came through two trials in London, I'm sure at great expense, and you were innocent. But you know, yeah. How did it all come about?
Well, no, I think Lalamodi has, you know, look, he tweeted out in 2010 with regards to why I was not included in the IPL. And look, it's there for everybody to read. So the fact is that, you know, you had the most important man in world cricket accusing you of that. So ultimately, we took action, and we were vindicated sort of 2 years later in the Royal Courts of Justice in a civil case. And then from that, so just to correct you, it wasn't actually Mr. Mordi that accused me the second time. So it was the British government. So with regards to the perjury side of things and the fact that I hadn't been truthful in that case. So Mr. Mordi was very much a bystander in that second one. But the fact is that, you know, we had to go through that harrowing experience of a criminal trial. And so the difficult part of that was understanding that it was going to be played out in the court of law. And so, you know, there's two courts when you're going through those scenarios. One is the court of public opinion, which is the media, and the second is the court of law. So, you know, we were never going to win, nor were we aiming to win the court of public opinion, because that was gone. That, you know, my role in that was already decided. And so for us, it was merely dealing with the facts and dealing with the case and dealing with everything in the court of law. And subsequently in 2015, yeah, it was a 9-week case and acquitted on the accusation of perjury. And so then it was a case of getting through that where, you know, for me, being able to, fall back on a commentary or a writing aspect, you know, that ability to earn was taken away. So I had to reinvent myself in that capacity. So that took time and sort of dealing through the process and whatnot. But look, there's mate, there's many nuances with regards to the case itself that I don't want to bore people with. And the main thing is that, you know, you do come through and you do rebuild, and you do move on. And that's this place that I find myself in now. And mate, I'm really happy.
So where you find yourself now, about 4 months ago, we run into each other and you tell me about something that is a very radical idea, because you think I'm maybe somebody that can look at it outside the box.
No, I just think you're a really conservative Scottishman.
So if you can convince me, you can convince anybody. Yeah, fuck Correct. Off. So like we speak and then for about 2 months later, because I had to take time to like digest it. And I remember one morning something happened and I was thinking, that guy was right, you know, and I'm going to go back and I'm going to engage. And we had another chat and I gave it my best devil's advocate stuff, and I went through that test and went through that test, and you know, we got to where we are today. Tell the listeners what your vision is for where sport goes now, the kind of thing it has to do to stay relevant with new generations, with new distribution models. We talk about that all the time here, and how that's going to happen and still keep old traditionalists like Grant Williams not mumping his gums.
Because I stalked you for a little while and read your blogs and your posts and listened to some podcasts, and then thought, look, yeah, if I can turn him, then I reckon I'm on track. And we've bounced a lot of stuff off, and you know, your opinions within not only the world of sport, I think, Roger, but you know, you come from outside of sport as well. So I far enjoy your music stories than I do your sporting stories. So with regards to where we sort of,
you've not heard many of them yet.
So with regards to what, you know, I first threw at you was that, look, if sport hasn't been disrupted, so if we use other industries as the benchmark for disruption, disruption is what you take away, not what you add. So if we looked at sport, what have we taken away from sport as Uber took away that traditional taxi element, as Airbnb took away the traditional hotel industry, as Amazon took away the hotel, the mall or the shopping mall or the retail industry? What has sport done? And so, mate, that was the thinking behind, well, we can't take away the players and we can't take away this, but you know, what if when I'm watching Super Rugby in New Zealand, the stadiums are half full or even quarter full? What if we actually focused entirely on the audience watching at home rather than the 5,000 or 2,500 people who are at the stadium? Because we have this perception in sport that it has to be in a venue or a stadium or an arena, and then you put the production around that, and then you play the game, and then that gets transmitted as the production feed, and that's what we see at home. So I sort of hunted high and low, and to cut a very long story short, tech today allows us to think differently about how we could deliver sport. So the 18 to 25s, they spend a lot of their time in rendered worlds via Epic Games' Unreal Engine, where those worlds of Fortnite and League of Legends and yes, Call of Duty, and where they spend time. So I'm thinking, well, rather than expecting them to come to a stadium or come and see sport as we've always done it, because we haven't done anything to sort of disrupt ourselves, what if we took the live game of basketball or chess or table tennis and put that into a rendered world? So we can place that live game with wonderful athletes in many niche sports that don't get much coverage or have low production value. And we use the skill of the Unreal Engine from Epic to actually build these magical environments, which are far better than what we see currently on TV. So So that was the premise of Smart Sports, and Smart Sports is the company I've created, and you know, I've got a good team of people on board and helping, and that's the tech partners in Oslo and you know, other consultants around, of which, Roger, you've, you know, gladly come on board and helped in a big way. And I think, you know, that all that I'm asking is that can we consider it? Am I right? I don't know. But I think it's worth considering, because if we don't look outside of how we deliver sport, that there's generation coming through who don't engage as we used to. And so can we try another way? I'm not saying get rid of arena sport. Gosh, no. Wimbledon, Twickenham, Lords, the Oval, magical places, fantastic places. But is there layers of sport that we could actually help with technology? So that's the sort of the pathway I'm on there.
Chris, you know, Roger and I go back and forward about this all the time. Mm. And you know, he's much deeper into it than I am. I come at it as a fan primarily. And my fear, as I've articulated to Roger on numerous occasions, is that you know, sport is in danger, I think, of eating itself. And by engaging on this level with a generation who are, let's face it, fickle in their tastes. You know, this week's Fortnite is next Fortnite something else. My worry is that you, by engaging them on that playing field, you run the risk of sports that have this entrenched place in the hearts and minds of humans for many, many years become another commodity, and then it becomes a question of, okay, well, how do we change the game to maintain the interest? And so you'll find potentially sports being forced to cannibalize themselves, change the rules, change the parameters of the game to try and maintain that audience who are being courted by all kinds of different things.
No, fair points. And my response or reply to that is that we've never asked athletes to look at a different way of delivering. For example, Bruce Springsteen or Ed Sheeran. Ed Sheeran will play Wembley, and he'll play in front of 60,000 people at a live concert, and it's visceral. You touch it, you feel it, you smell it. No different than if you've got England playing at Wembley against France. So that's an experience. It's a delivery that the musician has. The musician then, Ed Sheeran, 6 weeks later, he goes into a recording studio in London in front of no one, and he records an album. And that album is enjoyed by a whole market, as is his concert enjoyed by a whole market. Hugh Jackman will go to the West End or Broadway and perform a play in front of a live audience, and it's again, visceral. 6 weeks later, he's on a Hollywood studio lot in front of no one, filming Wolverine, and it's going to be seen by millions of people, tens of millions of people. What I'm saying, mate, is that I don't think what I believe is that potentially we can actually enhance the live experience by bringing this generation or a generation into sport. So if we bring it. The beauty of a great athlete, a wonderful women's basketball player, or a great women's soccer player, a top draw rugby player that are playing in environments, or squash player or badminton player that are playing in these environments. If you can bring two people or three people out of 10 that didn't watch it beforehand because you've placed it in this world, will they then follow that game? And then does that mean that their interest goes into the fact that actually the world champs are on in London? Yeah, okay, I know who those players are. I've seen them. I enjoy what they do. So what I'm sort of saying, is it a way to catch the ones we're missing to enhance the stadium environment? So I don't see me as being detrimental or competing. I would like to think that it's complementing, because we can't keep singing the same song that we've done forever because they're not listening. And so if we sing a different song, could we catch more of them? And so, like I said, I don't know if I'm right. I think my theory is worth exploring. And so we've managed to get a showreel up, and you know, Smart Sports was in Vegas a couple of weeks ago at NAB, and you know, we were there with our wonderful tech partners from Oslo, and so I'm pushing the envelope with regards to where we can do this, but I'm wanting to pose questions, because if we keep playing in arenas and stadiums and venues, I'm fearful that, you know, we're gonna tip off. So could we explore another way? But that opens up the beauty of the live event. So mate, that's sort of the method in the madness, if you like.
No, you know, it's a great answer. I mean, just hearing that, Rog, I realise what a lousy job you've done of countering my fears.
Thanks,
about all
man.
That stuff. It is fascinating, and it's, you know, these virtual worlds are, you know, getting more realistic, and I can completely understand how that you can drag people into this. But I just, you know, it's interesting that this is coming, this kind of move to take people, not take people away from the live event, but giving people an alternative to that live event, is happening at the exact same time as we have just tremendous pressure on ticket prices from something Roger
and infrastructure,
about, the big eventers, you know,
and infrastructure cost. You know, you look at the Rams and the Chargers stadium in Brentwood. I mean, I think it was mooted for around $2.5 billion. I think it's blown out to like $4 billion, if not more. You look at the rebuilds that are going to be going on around, because the one thing is the $10 or $14 per month beauty of what Netflix has given, I think, us as consumers, is just a seamless experience. So all of these wonderful digital experiences that we get, unfortunately, mate, sport is so far behind, because when people go along to those events, the toilets stink, it's a ball ache to get up to your seat, there's no replay screens, you're charging me through the nose for food and drink. Like, you're taking the piss. But when we have experiences like Uber and Netflix, there's value, and that's fear. But I think with sport at those live events, I think it goes the other way, and I think that pushes sometimes people away. So that's something that we need as sport to look at that live experience. But mate, I only see things like Wimbledon, and I see the Six Nations on TV recently, and the Masters. Like, those events are only going from strength to strength, like that blue chip sporting property. And we've just got to be careful of the underbelly, that, you know, if we keep trying to perhaps do that the same way, maybe we can just experiment a bit and find out if that's going to resonate.
It is a great point. I mean, what do you think the tipping point is? Because you know, prices, as you said, are going through the roof. Not just infrastructure, but compensation for athletes, merchandising rights, and that necessarily, I guess, means ticket prices are going through the roof. And this is kind of happening exactly at the point where, as you say, you're going to be able to create alternatives for people. What's the tipping point, you think? Because I just see so many ways that this whole thing can kind of just collapse in on itself.
I think it goes the other way, Grant. I think it has the opportunity to blossom. And by what I mean is that I think it can punch through, in the fact that if we can look at the alternative and engage that potential younger audience, if we have the best table tennis players playing in a digital table tennis tournament, it's only going to be one tournament of the year. There are still those magical tournaments that people can attend and go to or watch, but it's just a different delivery. So, you know, what's a tipping point? I think because the sporting right environment, the broadcast right, it's so fractured at the moment, you know, and people are unsure about whether it's going to be cable or is it OTT, when is Amazon going to have a crack, when's Facebook going to throw some money down, you know, after what they did with the IPL, or, you know, what's Apple going to do, is Netflix ever going to get into sport? And yet still there's the technical perhaps deficiency around latency and around the capability to deliver a solid feed to go out over digital. But within 5 to 10 years, those problems digitally are not going to exist. And if you're a domestic cable operator, I reckon you're on life support. It's just inevitable that it will go digital. And how big, with who, that's what I think everybody is working out, and that's the flux situation that sport finds itself in at the moment. And whether you go B2C, you know, is the NFL big enough to go? I mean, the direct to consumer. I saw the chairman from Crystal Palace say that, well, you know, rather than us getting the rights, if we just went direct to our 100 million fans around the world and they paid X amount of 40 quid per year, you know, is that where we need to go? But then you've got to set the platform up, you've got to take the risk. So it's really unknown, you know, and all that we're trying to do is perhaps look at some sports out there that are perhaps underserviced with great athletes. I mean, there's LeBron James's in Sepak Takraw, which is a crazy game out of Malaysia where guys kick a ball over a net like a volleyball scenario. Yet those athletes work just as hard as the top athletes. But can we advance that production capability? Maybe we can. And so that's, you know, again, that's where we're focused. So, but it's a fascinating time for sport. It really is.
You know, Chris, I think it kind of plays into my old theme of polarization. As you say, I think, you know, the blue ribboned events, the big eventer tournaments and sports, they will be fine, and they will go from strength to strength for the people that can afford those tickets. In terms of smaller sports, and there's plenty of them that have just not been able to expand because the cost of travel and logistics and empty stadia is overwhelming, I think, you know, what you're doing is interesting. And you know, it was very, very funny to see the Royal Shakespeare Company, you know, talk about
Did you see that?
I mean, I mean, like, this is the way it's going, you know. And, you know, it's hitting two things. I think it's hitting, as I say, those sports that just haven't had the business model to pay for empty stadia and travel and everything like that. I think this solves it. But secondly, you know, we had once this conversation that, you know, I'm not a big fan of 2020 cricket, and, you know, I love my test matches, and, you know, I gave you a hard time on that. And you were saying to me, look, we get them to test cricket at the top of the pyramid by introducing them to a more snackable type format. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
I think, mate, I think you're right. I mean, look, our first drink of alcohol wasn't Verve or Moet. It was some skanky Alka-Pop, which, you know, we ordered ridiculously horrible cider or some really horrible brew. But I mean, you know, our palate changes. So, and again, Grant, I mean, going back to your point about are we going to cannibalize ourselves? I think people mature, people grow, people evolve. And I think the beauty of sport, and what I don't want to see, is too much dilution of a game. I mean, 2020 was diluted down from the test side, but I've just sort of seen there's, you know, you've got the rugby and then the sevens, and now there's a fives that's sort of coming out, and England are now going to the 100 competition off the back of what they're doing. So, you know, part of me is like, I still would like to see the essence of it maintained. You know, we're searching for these answers about how do we stimulate that audience coming through? How do we do it? Do we change? I'm of the thinking that, well, you know, rather than doing that side of it and expecting them to turn up again just to watch a rehash of what you've already done, let's get the game as we know it, and again, put it in their world. Put it in their world, which is just fantastic, and then we can develop that. We can, from a sponsorship and a marketing point of view, commercial point of view, it's limitless because it's rendered. So our ability to engage, our ability to storytell is so much more highlighted because of the technology that allows us to do that. And for me, that's what we haven't explored in sport. We haven't taken anything away. We keep adding games. We keep adding rules. We keep adding all this other stuff. And it's like, well, let's take some stuff away. Let's give that a crack.
I think that's probably the where we're going to try and end it up.
Cool,
wrap it up.
All good. Yeah.
I think we've covered so much. Grant, is there anything else you want to
Oh, it's been fascinating. My problem is I'm so fascinated by all this, particularly having the chance to get inside the mind of a top athlete and understand how this whole thing works. Because as a fan, I've followed just about every sport on the planet, and it fascinates me. But it fascinates me. Somebody once asked me. They said, why do you want to watch sport? I just don't get it. I don't get what you're not playing. Why do you want to watch it? And I kind of thought about it for a long time, and I realized that the answer ultimately came to me. It was because every time I watch a sporting event, I see somebody do something that I couldn't do, and just being able to see that and say to get inside the minds of the people that have played, particularly at the top level, where the gap. We spoke to Eddie about this last week. The gap between being a good golfer and a tour quality pro golfer is enormous, and it's the same in cricket. It's the same in rugby. That last step up
But it's amazing, mate, how the perception is enormous, but it's actually one percenters. Do you know what? So people often think that there's this quantum jump that sort of has to occur. Look, for the freaks like Zidane or Rafa or Tendulkar or those sort of, they're in another category. There's very few of them. But for the majority of us, mate, it's the one percenters. Honestly, it's amazing how little the difference is that makes the big difference, if that sort of makes any sense at all.
It doesn't.
Attention to detail at that level that makes it look big, because it's just your commitment to the one percenters. And mate, to sort of search like a 400 meter runner, it's not who's speeding up at the end, it's who's slowing down the least. So that's all it is about. It's just you got to hold your shape and keep your one percenters, and that gives you, and so the further the game goes, the longer you hold on to your one percenters, mate, the further you get out from the rest of the field, because you've maintained your shape basically, and so that's sort of a bit of the myth on what you actually require. It's amazing how little the difference is.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, let me ask you one final question, because at this point it's very easy to say, you talk about that 1%, Chris. What's the best advice you'd give a young kid trying to make it, et cetera, et cetera? But let me twist that a little bit, because you, as the son of a famous and a 1%er father, what advice would you give to a parent who's trying to help their son? They spotted a talent.
Or daughter.
Or daughter, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Rog. What was the best advice you can give the parents to say, here's something you should think about when you're trying to help your kids make that last leap?
Mate, Roger Grant, his questions are fucking way better than yours. Does that happen every week?
No, it's this, Jesus. And he's got the great radio voice. And fuck's sake.
I just thought I was ahead because I'm not Scottish.
Mate, his questions are just so much better than yours. But look, that the parenting side, again, I don't know the answer, in the fact that it's because I sort of think it's in the kid, in that, because I was through tantrums and mate, give me a kid that hurts, like when they're 8 or 9, if they get out or miss a goal or aren't selected and are upset. That's sort of like when Arsene Wenger says, give me the dude with speed and I can teach him how to play football. But if someone can play football and he doesn't have any speed, I can't do anything with that. So it's sort of like, if you identify in your daughter or your son that, there's this trait, especially the trait, which is, it just hurts and it means something. That's when you have to be really careful, because you don't want to snub that out. You don't want to, in today's world, you get a trophy for finishing fourth. And it's like the person who finishes first is almost the freak. So it's like you want to make sure that you encourage and you understand and you let them go with those tantrums and whatnot. But I think the one thing about any of that, man, I think as a parent, is that is just ethic and the fact that, you make sure that they understand that it's they play and they practice and it's done properly. I think that, again, attention to detail, I think does help in the long run. And if there's anything that I could offer, would just be that it's that attention to detail with regards to being there on time. It's all those, again, it's the one percenters, you know, it's like, it's that being there on time, pack your bag, make sure your shoes are clean. It's those ridiculous little things that actually shape the way you go about things. And I think that it's those things that aren't on the cricket field, which can often influence the most off the field, can influence on the field.
Yeah, it's again, this is one of those things I find fascinating, that in a world like sport, which is changing so much, you're right, it does go back to you know, cleaning your shoes and showing up on 100%. Time.
And that's never changed. All the great athletes, you know, it is preparation. It is making sure you say thank you to the umpires. It is making sure you shake hands with the opposition regardless of the result. It's that stuff which is actually not the cricket or the football side of things, that's just sort of an ethic. And I think if that's what you can keep instilling, then I think you set a good foundation.
Fantastic. Chris, this has been, it's just so much fun. The time has flown by, and hopefully we can do this again sometime, because I'd love to talk to you some more about this.
It was great with you, Grant, and average with you, Rog. Thanks.
Take care, Chris. Bye.
See you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Cheers. Bye.
Great.
Well, Rog, I've got to say that flew by. I mean, I could have sat there all day talking to Chris. What a top bloke. What a fascinating life.
I think so.
And I just have so much respect for him for going through what he's been through and holding his head up and coming out the other side, you know, completely exonerated. And that's a very hard thing to do in a public arena. It's one thing to do it in private, but to do it in public when a bunch of people are going to throw opinions that aren't wanted and are devoid of the basis of fact, it's just such a much harder thing to do. So to come through that, to maintain your dignity and your sense of humor, and then to reinvent yourself, what a fantastic guy. I'm just so impressed by Chris.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, cricket as a sport, as a culture, you know, I always remember, you know, the Ian Botham at the bottom of his performance as captain, when, you know, I think he got a double duck, or certainly scored very low in both innings, you know, and he's walking back up to the pavilion, I'm sure it was at Lord's, and all those old boys and ties just dropped their heads and just abandoned them, you know. And those were the same guys that, you know, two tests later or one test later at Headingley are talking about, you know, the hero of Boyzone, yeah. You know. And cricket, I think, sometimes needs to look at itself. You know, as you say, Chris has had an amazing story. And I just so happy that he's found the strength to come back with what I think is a knockout idea. I think it's going to find its niche. And I think it's going to be something that we're talking about for a while.
All right. Well, look, on that note, let's wrap it up for another week. Between now and next week, please do download, rate, review the podcast. Tell your friends. Share the love. Share the word. Follow us on Twitter. And you'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E, at EntertainedR. You can follow me at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always,
thank
fun
you.
Times never stop.
Thanks for getting up early, mate. Take care. Yeah.